Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. And today we're talking about a topic that has personally fascinated me for years, the evolution of Roman weapons.
And that really is a massive field. We're talking about a development that spans over, wait, let me put this in perspective, from the founding of the Republic, so roughly 509 BC, all the way to the fall of the Western Roman Empire in 476 AD. That's over 900 years of military history.
And that's exactly what makes the Romans so remarkable. 900 years in which a small city-state on the Tiber transformed into the dominant military power of the ancient world. From Britain to North Africa, from Spain to Syria. And that wasn't because they had one wonder weapon that overpowered everything.
No, and that's really the central thesis for today. Rome's strength lay in the system, in the ability to adapt to standardize equipment and, this is what I find particularly fascinating, to learn from their enemies. When they fought the Celts and saw that their chainmail worked well, they adopted it and improved it. When Iberian swords proved superior in close combat, that became the gladius.
That's a point you really can't emphasize enough. Other ancient armies often stuck with one tried and tested concept. The Greek hoplites with their phalanx, for example. A fantastic formation, no question, but relatively rigid. If the terrain didn't suit it or the enemy behaved differently than expected, they had a problem. The Romans, on the other hand, constantly evolved both their tactics and their weapons.
And that's exactly the arc we want to trace today. From the early citizen soldiers who still had to bring their own equipment, through the
Marian reforms, which turned everything upside down, all the way to late antiquity, when suddenly cavalry became more important than heavy infantry.
That sums it up, and you really can break this down into phases. Early Republic with phalanx tactics, Middle Republic with the flexible maniple formation, Late Republic with professionalization under Marius, then the Imperial period as the pinnacle of standardization, and finally Late Antiquity with its own unique set of challenges. Five major periods, and in each one, something decisive happens with the weaponry.
What also fascinates me about this topic is how present it all still is today. If you go to a Roman festival, and there are some really big events these days, the Roman festival in Xanten, for example, where hundreds of reenactors come together, you can see how meticulously people reconstruct this equipment. They work from archaeological finds as templates, sometimes even using original materials.
And that just goes to show how well engineered this equipment was. If you try to rebuild a Lorica segmentata today, this segmented plate armor, you start to realize just how much engineering skill went into it. These aren't primitive strips of metal. It's a sophisticated system of overlapping plates, leather straps, and metal hooks.
And it's also interesting for the LARP community, because Roman aesthetics are so instantly recognizable. That interplay of the large rectangular shield, the gladius at the side, the helmet with cheek guards, it's one of the most iconic silhouettes in military history. Just an outline is enough, and everyone immediately knows Roman.
And that was already intentional back then. That uniform appearance had an enormous psychological effect. When a legion marches toward you, all identically equipped in perfect formation, that must have been terrifying.
Especially because behind it all was this system. These weren't ragtag troops with random equipment. Every soldier had standardized weapons that were designed to work together. First, throw the pilum, then go into close combat with the gladius. That was a carefully planned sequence, refined over centuries.
And the mass production behind it was unprecedented for the ancient world. They had state-run weapons factories, known as fabricae, which were specifically designed to manufacture individual pieces of equipment in series. This allowed for quality control and interchangeability that other armies simply didn't have. If a legionary lost his gladius, he got a new one, and it functioned identically.
And these are exactly the topics we want to walk through today, step by step. The individual weapons, the armor, the tactics, and above all, how it all connected. Because with the Romans, you really can't look at anything in isolation.
The weapon only makes sense in the context of the formation only in the context of the training, and the training only in the context of the
overall strategy. Everything interlocks.
And with that, we'd best start right at the beginning, with the early days of the Republic, when Rome was still a small city that had to hold its own against its neighbours.
So, the beginnings. And when you look at the early Roman Republic, you first have to let go of that image of perfectly equipped legionaries. It was a completely different world.
Quite literally, a citizen army. It operated on a militia system. If you were a Roman citizen of military age, you had to serve. But, and this is the crucial point, everyone brought their own equipment. The state didn't provide it.
Which means your armament depended directly on how deep your pockets were. The so-called Servian system divided citizens into wealth classes, 5 in total. And depending on which class you fell into, you had to bring specific equipment. The first class, the wealthiest, came fully kitted out. Bronze helmet, breastplate, greaves, round shield, sword, and spear. They looked like Greek hoplites.
And then it went down from there, step by step. The second and third classes no longer had a breastplate, but still carried a round shield. It was a phalanx, after all. You needed that closed shield wall. The fourth class had only a shield and spear, no helmet, no armor. And the fifth class? They showed up with slings and stones. More or less.
And you really have to let that sink in. This wasn't a democratic system, even though we call it a republic. At its core, it was plutocratic. If you had money, you stood in the front in the best armor. If you were poor, you stood in the back with a sling and hoped it wouldn't come to hand-to-hand combat.
Although the wealthy also bore the greatest risk, they stood in the front ranks of the phalanx. It was civic duty and privilege at the same time. Whoever had the right to wear the most expensive equipment also had the duty to be the first to march into the enemy.
And the tactic was precisely this phalanx, a dense line of spearmen, shield to shield, advancing in a closed formation toward the enemy.
Exactly, rolling forward like a wall. But the Romans didn't invent this themselves. It was adopted. Partly from the Etruscans, partly from the Greeks. In military terms, the early Romans were imitators, not innovators. The helmets were of Etruscan Greek design, the swords of Etruscan make. The entire formation was imported.
And that worked for a while, as long as the Romans were fighting on flat ground against similarly organized opponents. The phalanx on flat terrain is a pretty formidable thing. Closed front, long spears projecting forward, overlapping shields. You don't want to run into that.
The problem came in the 4th century BC when the Romans clashed with the Samnites. The Samnite Wars, 3 of them in total, from 343 to 290 BC. And the Samnites lived in the mountains of central Italy, in what's now Campania and the surrounding area. And that's where the phalanx's limitations were brutally exposed.
Because a closed phalanx simply doesn't work on a narrow mountain path. You need level ground. You need room for the spears. You need a continuous line. In the mountains, you've got slopes, bottlenecks, ravines. The formation just falls apart.
The most famous example is the defeat at the Caudine Forks in 321 BC, Second Samnite War. The Romans walked right into a trap without a proper battle, were surrounded and had to surrender. A total humiliation, and together with the other experiences from the Samnite Wars, it helped drive the move away from the rigid phalanx.
And one of the triggers for a fundamental rethinking. The Romans learned from it, as they always did, one has to say.
And the answer was the manipular system. Instead of a rigid phalanx, the legion was now divided into smaller units, the maniples. These could maneuver independently, adapt to the terrain, close gaps, and evade.
That was a completely different approach. The maniples consisted of three lines. The hastati at the front, the youngest soldiers, then the principes in the middle, more experienced fighters, and at the back, the triarii, the veterans with long spears as the last reserve. And each of these groups could operate independently.
And the crucial thing? The weaponry changed along with it. In a phalanx, you need a long spear and a heavy round shield. In the maniple formation, you need a shorter sword for close combat, a javelin to break up the enemy formation, and a shield that's lighter and more versatile.
So, essentially, the beginning of what would later become the classic Roman
legionary equipment. The foundation for the gladius, the pilum, and the scutum was laid here, even though the weapons continued to evolve.
Although it has to be stressed that this wasn't a switch that was simply flipped. It was a process that took decades. Scholars estimate around 20 to 30 years during which the Romans gradually transitioned from the phalanx to the manipular system. And the standardization of equipment didn't happen overnight either.
That came slowly. Only once the manipular system had proven itself, and it certainly did in the conflicts of the Middle Republic against Carthage and the Hellenistic kingdoms, that's when the equipment became more and more uniform. But in the early Republic, it was still very heterogeneous. Every citizen soldier with whatever he could afford.
And that's actually what's so fascinating about this phase. You're watching an army that learns out of necessity. The phalanx fails in the mountains, so they invent something better. The citizen army hits its limits, so they begin to standardize. Every crisis becomes the catalyst for the next stage of development.
And with that, the foundation was laid for everything that followed. Without the Samnite Wars, without that forced rethinking, the Roman military machine as we know it probably would never have existed.
The mountains of Samnium forced Rome to become flexible. And flexibility became its hallmark.
So, with the manipular system, the Romans now had a flexible formation. But the real test only came during the Middle Republic. And it was a tough one. The Punic Wars against Carthage, the conflicts with the Hellenistic kingdoms in the east, constant clashes with the Gauls. Rome was virtually at war non-stop.
And it was precisely this constant pressure that drove weapon development forward. Because in every conflict, the Romans encountered opponents who had something that was better than what they had. And then that quintessentially Roman pragmatism kicked in. Whatever the enemy does well, we adopt.
The prime example is the gladius. The sword that everyone associates with Rome was not a Roman invention. The Romans picked it up during the Second Punic War between 218 and 201 BC from the Catiberians on the Iberian Peninsula. The gladius hispaniensis, as it was initially called, was a sword with a broad, leaf-shaped blade. The blade around 60 to 65 centimeters long, total length over 70. The Romans saw how effective it was in close combat and simply adopted it.
And then, of course, improved it, because that's the key point. They didn't just copy it, they adapted it to their own fighting style. The blade became shorter, straighter, more optimized for thrusting. In the end, the blade length was maybe 45 to 55 centimeters. Perfect for the tight confines of formation combat, where you can't take a wide swing.
And alongside that, the pilum became the standard throwing weapon. That wasn't a purely Roman concept either. Heavy javelins already existed before. But the Romans built in this ingenious detail. The long, thin shaft made of tough iron that gets stuck in the enemy's shield. The pilum punches through the shield, can barely be pulled out, and renders the shield practically useless. Brilliantly simple.
And together with the chainmail, the lorica hamata, and the standardized scutum, they now had an equipment combination that was truly coordinated. First throw the pila, then close in with shield and gladius. It was a system, not a random collection of individual weapons.
But there was still a fundamental problem. The army was still based on the militia system. Soldiers were conscripted for individual campaigns and then sent home afterwards. And as the empire expanded, the campaigns got longer and took them further and further away. Farmers lost their farms because they spent years in the field.
And that pushed the whole system to its breaking point. There simply weren't enough qualified citizen soldiers with the necessary wealth anymore. The army had a recruitment problem.
And this is where Gaius Marius enters the picture. Late 2nd century BC, when the Cimbri and Teutones were threatening from the north, and Rome had already suffered some painful defeats, Marius fundamentally restructured the military. He opened the army to all Roman citizens, regardless of wealth. Even the so-called capite censi, the propertyless, who had previously been excluded, could now serve.
And the state provided the equipment. That was the decisive point. No longer did the soldier buy his own weapons. Instead, the commander equipped his troops. This made genuine standardization possible for the first time. Every legionary with the same equipment, regardless of whether he'd been a farmer or a day laborer before.
And on top of that came a whole series of additional measures. The legion was reorganized into cohorts, 10 cohorts per legion, roughly 5,000 men. There was the legion eagle as a unified...
Right, the standard was the Aquila, and the famous Marius's mules, although that actually referred to the soldiers themselves. They now had to carry all their marching gear themselves to reduce the baggage train.
That was up to 30, maybe 40 kilograms. It's no wonder the legionaries were also called muli mariani, Marius's mules. Equipment, provisions for a good 2 weeks, cooking gear, entrenching tools. And with all that, they marched 20 to 30 kilometers a day. That's quite a feat.
But what I think is particularly important about the Marian reforms, and this is often underestimated, is the social dimension. You see, Marius didn't just solve a military problem. He created a political time bomb. Because these new soldiers, the propertyless ones, had nothing after their service was over. No land, no pension, no safety net.
And who took care of their land allotments after service? Not the Senate, which regularly blocked such measures, but...
The commander, exactly. And that's where the explosive potential lay. The soldiers' loyalty shifted from the state to the commander. Marius's legions were his legions. Sulla's legions were his legions. And when Sulla marched on Rome with his own legions in 88 BC, the first Roman commander ever to do so, you could see where this was heading.
And this dynamic then ran through the entire late Republic. Caesar, Pompey, and eventually Octavian and Mark Antony, they could mobilize their armies because the soldiers were personally loyal to them. By the way, if you find these connections between military history and politics as fascinating as we do, feel free to subscribe or recommend us to others. That kind of feedback really helps us a lot.
And what the Civil Wars meant for weapons technology is also interesting. When Romans fought Romans, both sides had identical equipment. You could no longer gain an edge through better weapons.
The advantage had to come from tactics, from experience, from, well, ultimately from having the better general. And from siege warfare. Caesar took siege weapons, ballistae, catapults, all those torsion artillery pieces, to a new level. Not because the technology was so different, but because he deployed them more systematically than anyone before him.
And to be fair, many historians today emphasize that the so-called Marian reforms were less a single revolutionary event and more the formalization of developments that had been underway for some time. The opening to poorer citizens, the increasing standardization, these trends were already visible. Marius consolidated and accelerated them.
But the result was an army that was fundamentally different from the citizen militia of the early period. Professional, standardized, loyal to the commander. The foundation for the legions that would later become the standing professional army of the empire under Augustus. You mentioned the gladius earlier as the prime example of an adopted weapon. Let's dig deeper into that, because the development of this weapon is truly remarkable.
Absolutely. And this development can almost be broken down into eras, depending on who the Romans were fighting at the time and how their tactics were evolving.
And then they did what was quintessentially Roman: adopt and improve. Over the centuries, a whole lineage of gladius types emerged, and it beautifully illustrates how Roman warfare evolved. The Hispaniensis at the beginning, then the Mainz type in the early imperial period, the Fulham type as a transitional form, and finally the Pompey type in the 1st century AD.
And each type got shorter and more specialized.
The Hispaniensis still had a leaf-shaped blade, sort of, how should I describe it, wider in the middle, then narrowing again, almost like a willow leaf, 60 to 68 centimeters long. It was still well suited for both cutting and thrusting. Then the Mainz type, which was already noticeably shorter, 50 to 55 centimeters, but still with that wasted blade shape. It weighed around 800 to 1000 grams, a solid weight for a short sword.
And then the Pompey type, which took the concept to its logical conclusion. Straight, parallel edges, triangular point, only 42 to 50 centimeters of blade. And it weighed maybe 700, 800 grams, so a good 20% lighter than the Mainz type. A steady weight reduction over a few centuries.
And that went hand in hand with a clear specialization. The earlier models could still do both, cut and thrust. The Pompey type was clearly a thrusting weapon. Short, straight blade, triangular point, optimized for precise stabs.
And there's a logic behind that which was completely counterintuitive for many of Rome's enemies. In most ancient cultures, the thinking was, the longer the blade, the better. A big sword you can swing wide. That does more damage, right? Sounds logical at first.
But in the reality it was,
in a tight formation, you simply don't have the room to swing a long sword. You're standing shoulder to shoulder with your comrades, the scutum on your left, your neighbour on your right. You've got maybe half a metre of space. If you try to swing a longsword in there, you're as likely to hit your own comrade as the enemy.
And that's exactly why the gladios worked so well. You don't need a big swing, you don't need a wide backswing. A short, powerful thrust forward, that's all. And you could do that dozens of times in a row without tiring, at just 700-800 grams of total weight.
And you really have to experience this for yourself. If you hold a replica in your hand, you immediately notice. The balance is incredible. The center of gravity sits close to the grip, not at the front of the blade. That means you have maximum control with minimal effort. A longsword, by contrast, pulls forward. You're constantly fighting against its weight. Over a full day of battle, that makes an enormous difference.
And then add the combination with the scutum. This wasn't the passive shield that you just had in front of you. It was used actively. You punched the opponent with the shield boss, the umbo, pushing him back, knocking him off balance. And the moment the enemy stumbles or his guard opens up for a split second, in goes the gladius.
Shield punch, spot the opening, gladius thrust. That was the three-step sequence the legionaries drilled thousands of times. And it only worked because the gladius was so short. With a longsword, after the shield punch, you wouldn't have had the space to bring the blade forward between you and the enemy.
And the psychological effect shouldn't be underestimated either. Rome's enemies were used to sword blows, big, sweeping movements that you could see and anticipate. But these short thrusts that suddenly shot out from beneath the shield were hard to read, especially for fighters from cultures that relied on open, swinging combat.
Although, to be honest, the gladius was effective as part of the system, not as an individual weapon. A lone legionary with his gladius, without the formation, without the scutum, against a Gaul with a longsword, that would have been a pretty uneven fight. The strength lay in the combination.
And the pugio, the dagger, fits into the same picture. It was the last resort. About 20 to 35 centimeters short, worn on the belt. If the gladius was lost, or the fighting got so close that even the gladius was too long, the pugio came into play.
So three tiers. Pilum for distance, gladius for close combat, pugio as a backup weapon. All thought through, all coordinated.
And then in the late imperial period, from around the 2nd or 3rd century AD, a fundamental shift occurred. Combat conditions changed. The Romans were increasingly fighting mounted opponents. Formations became more open. Cavalry grew in importance. And suddenly, a short sword was no longer ideal.
Because in an open formation, and especially on horseback, you need reach. A 45-centimeter blade doesn't help you much.
And the answer was the Sparta. 60 to 85 centimeters of blade length, the cavalry versions tending toward the upper end, originally a pure cavalry weapon. But over the course of the 3rd century, the infantry adopted the Sparta as well. It was a gradual process over decades, with transitional forms like the semi-Sparta.
And that actually brings things full circle. The Romans in the early period had longer swords than the later gladius. Then they moved to the gladius, a short, specialized thrusting weapon. And in the end, they went back to a longer sword, because the combat conditions had changed. It was never about one perfect weapon. It was always about the right weapon for the particular
situation and era. And that really says everything about the Roman approach. No dogma, just pragmatism.
Now we come to the pilum, and for me personally, this is one of the most fascinating weapons of antiquity. Not because it's particularly beautiful or particularly deadly, but because of the engineering logic behind it.
What do you mean?
The pilum was a weapon that was designed to break. That completely goes against our modern thinking. We want weapons that last, that are robust, that can be reused. The Romans engineered a weapon where the destruction was part of the plan.
Let's take a look at how it was actually constructed. You had a wooden shaft, usually ash, about 1 meter long. And on top of that sat a long, thin iron shank, also close to a meter, with a hardened pyramidal tip. So the total length was around 2 meters. The weight varied depending on the version, between roughly 2 to maybe 3.5 kilos for the standard models.
And the key detail was in the junction between wood and iron. There were two basic construction methods. In the Tang-style pilum, a flat metal tongue was inserted into a slot in the wooden shaft and riveted. In the socket-style pilum, a metal sleeve was slid over the shaft. Both variants had the same principle. The iron tip was hardened. The long, thin iron shank behind it could bend on impact. Not because it was deliberately soft, but because its length and thinness made it flex under the force.
And when the pilum hit a shield,
the hardened tip punched through, but the thin iron shank behind it bent under the impact. And a bent pilum stuck in your shield is a massive problem. You can't pull it out. You can't hold the shield properly anymore because there's a 2 meter long bent piece of metal hanging off it. So you have to throw the shield away.
And then you're standing there without cover, at the exact moment the Roman legionaries draw their gladii and charge at you. That was no coincidence. That was the tactical sequence. First the pila, then the swords.
And that is the true genius of it. The weapons weren't individually brilliant. The pilum on its own is a bulky, heavy javelin. But working together, as a system, it was devastating. Pilum neutralizes the shield. Gladius finishes the job.
Legionaries typically carried one or two pila. That varied depending on the era and the unit. The first volley was thrown on command, often at a distance of maybe 20 to 30 meters. Then, usually, a second volley followed, and immediately after that, the charge with drawn gladius. The time between the last pilum throw and the collision was a matter of seconds. The enemy had no chance to reorganize.
And the psychological effect was considerable. Imagine standing there as a Gallic warrior and suddenly hundreds of heavy spears are flying toward you. You see them coming, you raise your shield, and then this thing is stuck in it, bending. The shield becomes useless, and before you can react, the legionaries are right in front of you.
And the pilum was further developed over the centuries. Marius, who didn't just reform the army, but apparently also had an eye for detail, is said by Plutarch to have introduced a clever modification. He reportedly replaced one of the two iron rivets connecting the iron shank to the wooden shaft with a wooden pin. However, this isn't archaeologically confirmed. Plutarch wrote it down about 200 years later and was a big Marius fan, so this is more a famous anecdote than an established fact.
If that were true, the wooden pin would have broken on impact, which would have made the
bending even more reliable, at least in theory, because the entire joint would no longer have had to absorb the full force of impact. Same pragmatism, different application.
And what makes the pilum so special becomes clear when you compare it to other ancient javelins. The Greek javelin was lighter, shorter, and used by skirmishers, an all-rounder that was actually meant to be thrown back. The Germanic flammia was similarly multi-purpose, designed as both a throwing spear and a close combat weapon.
The pilum, on the other hand, was a pure specialist. It could only be thrown. It was unsuitable for close combat, and it was essentially useless after a single use. But in that one function, the massive shield-destroying throw just before close combat, it was superior to every other javelin.
The penetrating power from the weight and long iron tip alone, the bending as a bonus, the fact that the enemy couldn't throw it back,
It was a single-use product with a threefold effect.
And of course, there were variants for different tactical purposes. Besides the standard peeler, there were heavier versions for heavily armored opponents and lighter ones for greater throwing distances, adapted to the particular tactical situation.
And in late antiquity, as the style of warfare changed and the legions needed to be more mobile, the pilum concept evolved into the plumbata. These were significantly smaller throwing darts, depending on the type, maybe 30 to 50 centimeters long and weighing only 130 to 400 grams, with an iron tip and a lead weight for the necessary mass. Soldiers carried four or five of them behind their shield.
This allowed them to throw the projectiles faster and more frequently than a 2-meter-long pilum. The principle remained the same: a ranged phase before close combat, but adapted to the new, more mobile style of warfare. That's the common thread running through the entire Roman military history. The idea stays the same, the form changes.
And when you look at the pilum system objectively, a weapon that's designed to break, that can only be used once, that had to be collected after battle and straightened again in the fabrique, you can see how much logistical thinking was behind it. That only works if you have the infrastructure to guarantee supply.
Without mass production in the state weapons factories, the pilum concept wouldn't have been viable. You can only afford a single-use weapon if you can manufacture and resupply it in large quantities. And that's exactly what the Romans could do. Now let's look at the defensive side of the equipment, the armor. And the evolution here is at least as fascinating as with the weapons, because it follows the same arc. From simple to complex, and then back to simple again.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
In the early Republic, when soldiers still provided their own equipment, body protection depended directly on the depth of your wallet. Wealthy citizens wore bronze breastplates, sometimes anatomically shaped, those muscle designs modeled on the Greek style, plus greaves, also made of bronze. Those who couldn't afford that wore a leather cuirass at best. And many of the poorer soldiers fought with essentially no body protection at all.
The first truly standardized armor was the Lurica Hamata, the chainmail, introduced in the 3rd century BC. And this too, typically Roman, was not their own invention. The Romans adopted the concept of chainmail from the Celts.
And then improved it. The Roman version of the Lorica Hamata consisted of thousands of interlocking iron rings, alternating between stamped and riveted rings. This created a flexible yet remarkably tough mesh. The weight was around 10 to 12 kilos, and anyone who's worn chainmail for a full day knows. The weight distributes well across the shoulders, but after 8 or 10 hours of marching and fighting, you feel every single kilo.
The Hamata offered good protection against sword blows and arrows, but was less effective against concentrated thrusting weapons. Those could push the rings apart. Still, it remained the standard armor for centuries because it offered a good compromise between protection, mobility, and above all...
Exactly, repairability. A damaged chainmail shirt could be patched up by the soldiers in the field. Insert new rings, done. That was an enormous logistical advantage.
And then, in the 1st century AD, the Lurica Segmentata enters the picture. The armor type that everyone immediately associates with Rome. Horizontal metal strips, arranged around the torso, overlapping, connected by leather straps and metal hooks. And the numbers are impressive. Only 5 to 9 kilos in weight, significantly lighter than the Hamata, with, well, comparable or even better protection. The overlapping plates distributed the force of blows more effectively than the ring mesh.
Although we should address the big myth right away.
The segmentata was undoubtedly a technological
advancement, yes. But it was far from as ubiquitous as movies and TV would have us believe. If you watch a Roman movie today, every legionary wears this plate armor. Historically, it was quite different. The segmentata was probably standard only in certain legions, and even there, it was worn alongside the hamata. The archaeological finds are concentrated in the Rhine and Danube regions and Britain, the northern frontiers. In the eastern part of the empire, it appears much less frequently.
And the time frame needs to be narrowed as well. The segmentata was in use from roughly the beginning of the 1st century AD to the 3rd century, so about 200 to 250 years. The hamata, by contrast, was in service from the 3rd century BC to the end of the empire, a good 700 years. In terms of longevity, the hamata was by far the more successful armor.
And the reason the segmentata never fully replaced the hamata was maintenance. The segmentata had dozens of metal hooks, leather straps, hinges, and rivets. Every one of these connection points was a potential weak spot. In the field, under combat conditions, that was a real problem. The leather straps dried out, the metal hooks bent, the rivets loosened. You constantly needed skilled craftsmen and spare parts.
The hamata, on the other hand, was robust, low maintenance, and could be repaired in the field. The segmentata was the technologically superior armor, on paper. In the harsh reality of a military campaign, the hamata was often the better choice.
And then there was a third option, the lorica squamata, the scale armor. Small overlapping metal plates sewn onto a backing material of cloth or leather. It offered a middle ground, lighter than the hamata, simpler than the segmentata. It was particularly popular with the cavalry and auxiliary troops.
And in the late imperial period, from the 3rd century onward, you see a trend that might at first glance look like a step backward. The elaborate segmentata gradually disappears. Instead, the hamata and squamata come back to the fore. Lighter, simpler armor is preferred.
But that wasn't simply a regression. It was a pragmatic response to changed conditions. The army was becoming more mobile, cavalry more important, threats were coming from all directions. What you needed were armors that could be produced quickly, were easy to maintain, and allowed freedom of movement.
Still, when you see the full arc, from simple bronze plates to chainmail to the highly developed segmentata and then back to chainmail, it really is remarkable. Innovation isn't a one-way street.
And in parallel, the helmets went through a similar evolution. The early models were of Etruscan and Greek design. Then came the Montefortino type, a conical bronze helmet with a characteristic knob on top and simple cheek guards. The Culus type followed, more rounded, more comfortable, also bronze, produced in Gallic workshops.
Then the Imperial Gallic helmet, probably the most recognizable. Iron instead of bronze, with an extended neck guard that was drawn down much further than on its predecessors, and improved cheek guards. Some examples even had reinforcing crossbars on the skull to deflect downward sword strikes. That was the helmet of the Golden Age.
And in late antiquity, the Spangenhelm. A segmented construction of individual iron plates riveted together with strips. Easier to manufacture than a helmet forged from a single piece, easy to adjust. Perhaps less elegant, but extremely functional.
The helmet evolution essentially tells the same story as the armor. From elaborate and specialized to pragmatic and suitable for mass production. Late Rome didn't lose its ingenuity, It lost the economic base to produce complex equipment in the necessary quantities.
The evolution of armor shows that military technology never exists in a vacuum. It depends on the economy, logistics, and the actual threats. The best armor in the world is useless if you can't produce it in sufficient numbers and maintain it in the field. Now, the scutum, the shield. And this is really a piece of equipment you only truly appreciate once you've held one in your hands. About 1.2 meters tall, roughly 80 centimeters wide, curved, and the construction was remarkably sophisticated.
It was essentially ancient plywood. Thin layers of wood, probably poplar or linden, light and tough wood, were cross-glued, meaning the grain was rotated 90 degrees with each layer. This created a core that was both strong and springy, and far less likely to splinter.
Over that came a covering of cowhide leather, which protected the wood and added extra rigidity. The edges were reinforced with a metal rim, usually bronze or iron, so the shield's edge wouldn't fray with every sword blow. And in the center sat the umbo, the metal shield boss, behind which the horizontal grip was located.
The total weight was around 7 to 10 kilos. That sounds like a lot at first, but thanks to the curvature, the weight distributes across the entire forearm rather than just the wrist. And that curvature was no accident. It was designed to deflect blows and projectiles rather than absorb them head on.
And the scutum were also painted with legion emblems, animal motifs, thunderbolts. That wasn't mere decoration. It served identification on the battlefield. From the shield painting, you could tell which legion and which cohort a soldier belonged to.
What impresses me most about the scutum, though, is its dual tactical function. Most people think of a shield as protection, as cover. But the scutum was equally an offensive weapon.
Shield punch. You ram the umbo into the enemy's chest or face, knock him off balance, his guard opens up for a split second, and then the gladius comes in. Punch, gap, stab. Always the same sequence, drilled thousands of times.
And all of this information while your comrades on either side are doing exactly the same thing. The scutum overlap in the shield wall. You're protecting yourself and your neighbor's flank at the same time. This isn't a lone fighter thing, this is
teamwork in tight quarters. And the scutum is the key to making it work. Without the rectangular shape, without the curvature, without the solid grip behind the umbo, none of it functions. With rectangular scutum, you get that dense, overlapping wall that Roman tactics required. Round shields need different techniques. A flat shield absorbs force instead of deflecting it.
And then, of course, there's the formation everyone knows, the testudo, the tortoise. The outer ranks hold their scutum to the front and sides, while the inner ranks raise theirs overhead. A sealed box of shields, protected from above, from the sides, from the front.
The testudo was especially used during sieges, when legionaries had to approach a wall under enemy arrow fire. That was
a special purpose formation, and that needs to be stressed. In film and television, you see the testudo portrayed as the Roman combat formation. In reality, it wasn't. The shield wall was the standard defensive formation for open field battle. The testudo was used situationally, when advancing under missile fire, during sieges, as a protective roof for the approach. But in actual close combat, it was too unwieldy.
Because in the testudo, you practically can't fight. You're packed so tightly together that you can neither use the gladius properly nor employ the shield offensively. It's a purely protective formation for getting to the fight, not for the fight itself.
Once the legionaries were close enough, they broke the testudo and transitioned into the shield wall or an open formation. Only then did the scutum become an offensive weapon.
As for the shield's evolution, it's also fascinating to see that the scutum was neither the beginning nor the end. In the early Republic, the Romans still carried oval or round shields, similar to Greek models. The rectangular curved scutum gradually prevailed alongside the more flexible formations, because the closed formations needed a shield that could fit together seamlessly.
And in the late imperial period, as formations opened up again and cavalry grew more important, many units returned to oval and round shields. Lighter, better suited for individual combat movements. Partly influenced by Germanic auxiliary troops who brought their own shield traditions.
The auxiliary troops often had different shields anyway. Smaller, oval models adapted to their combat style. And the cavalry needed even lighter shields that could be wielded with one hand while the other held the reins or a lance.
So the scutum in its classic form was, much like the segmentata among armors, a product of the Golden Age. It worked perfectly within the system of the disciplined cohort formation. But when the style of warfare changed, the shield had to adapt too. The scutum didn't disappear because it was flawed. It disappeared because warfare had changed.
And that's perhaps the most remarkable thing. The Romans never clung to a single design. When reality changed, they changed their equipment, not the other way around.
Now let's move beyond the standard equipment of the individual legionary and look at the bigger picture. Because the Roman military machine had quite different tools in its arsenal. Let's start with the siege weapons.
This was an area where the Romans truly excelled. And here too, they freely borrowed from others. The foundations came from the Greek and Hellenistic tradition. But the Romans took it all to a completely different level.
The two main types were the ballista and the onaga. The ballista essentially worked like a giant crossbow, a torsion mechanism with twisted sinew bundles that fired massive bolts or smaller stones. Extremely accurate, lethal at range. It was used to pick off defenders on city walls.
And the onaga, sometimes simply called a catapult, was the brute force. Large stones, incendiary charges, sometimes even barrels of flammable material. It wasn't as accurate, but it was devastating against masonry and fortifications.
On top of that came siege towers. Mobile wooden structures on wheels, several stories high, covered with wet animal hides to protect against fire arrows. And battering rams in sheltered housings, used against gates and walls. Roman siegecraft was so effective that it influenced ancient urban planning across the board. Cities had to massively reinforce their fortifications once Rome appeared at the gates.
And what made all of this possible was the infrastructure behind it. The fabricae, the state weapons factories. That's an aspect that's often underestimated.
The fabricae were basically the, how should I put it, the ancient equivalent of a
defense industry. Centralized production with quality control and specialization. The Notitia Dignitatum, a late Roman administrative document, lists over 100 such fabricae across the entire empire. And they weren't just all-purpose smithies. There were scutarii for shields, gladiarii for swords, ballistarii for artillery, loricarii for armor. Each factory specialized in a specific type of equipment.
And strategically distributed. The largest centers were located along the frontiers, on the Rhine, on the Danube, where demand was highest. Major sites in the west included Arles, Lyon and Milan. In Illyricum, Sirmium and Aquileia, plus various others in the east.
The system functioned for centuries and enabled Rome to quickly replace losses and rapidly equip new units. That might sound like a logistical detail, but that was one of the decisive advantages over many opponents who relied on individual craftsmen or small local workshops.
And then there's this theme that runs through the entire Roman military history, the willingness to learn from others. The sword from the Celtiberians, the chainmail from the Celts, composite bows from the East. Gladius, copied. Lorica Hamata, copied. Siege techniques, adopted from the Greeks and perfected.
And that wasn't a sign of weakness. For the Romans, it was pure common sense. In many other ancient cultures, it was considered dishonorable to adopt the enemy's weapons. The Romans had absolutely no problem with it. If something worked better than their own solution, they adopted it.
They even elevated it to an art form. The best example from the later period is the cataphracts. When the Romans encountered the heavily armored riders of the Parthians and later the Sassanids in the east, it was initially a shock for an infantry-centered army. These fully armored riders on armored horses with long lances, Rome had never faced anything quite like it.
And the response was, we'll build our own. The Romans raised their own cataphracts, known as the Clibanarii. Heavily armoured cavalry in scale or lamella armour for both rider and horse, armed with the long contus and often with bows as well. The earliest attested units date from the early 2nd century, probably raised around 115 AD under Trajan, though they're only securely documented by inscription under Hadrian. But they really gained in importance from the 3rd century under
Gallienus, who massively upgraded the entire cavalry. And this brings us to a fundamental shift that runs through all of late antiquity. Heavy infantry, the backbone of Rome for centuries, takes a backseat. Cavalry gains massively in importance, even though the infantry, of course, never completely disappeared.
And that transforms the entire equipment picture. The spatha, the longer sword, replaces the gladius as the standard weapon, even for the infantry. Because in more open formations, you need greater reach. Armour becomes lighter, more mobile. New throwing weapons like the plumbata appear. Small, lead-weighted darts that infantry can throw faster and more often than the heavy pilum.
And the auxiliary troops, the non-citizen units, play an ever larger role. Syrian archers with their composite bows, Germanic cavalry units with their own fighting traditions, Mauritanian light cavalry. The army becomes more diverse, less uniform, but also more versatile.
What you have to keep in mind here is that this wasn't a chaotic disintegration. It was an attempt to respond to a fundamentally changing threat landscape. Germanic tribes who no longer fought set-piece battles, but struck in swift raids. The Sassanids in the east with their overwhelming cavalry, the Huns from the steppe. Against all these enemies, the classic heavy infantry line was no longer the optimal tool.
And the fabrica were working at full capacity to manage this transition. New weapon types had to be produced in large numbers. The spatha required different forging techniques than the shorter gladius. Cavalry armor had different requirements than infantry armor. It was an enormous logistical challenge for an empire that was simultaneously under pressure on every front.
And ultimately, this is the phase that shows that the Romans' adaptability, while impressive, also had its limits. You can produce the best equipment in the world, but when the economic base crumbles, the borders become too long, and the threats change faster than you can respond, even the most sophisticated system reaches its limits.
If we now take a broad look back at everything we've discussed, from the citizen soldiers of the early Republic who brought their own gear, through the highly standardized professional army of the imperial period, to the mobile, lightly armored units of late antiquity, one thing stands out. It was not a linear progression.
It was a wave-like motion. Innovation, consolidation, simplification. Armor went from simple to complex and back to simple. Swords from longer to shorter and back to longer again.
relative to the respective fighting style. Formations from rigid to flexible, then flexible in a different way. Always driven by the concrete question, what do we need now against this enemy on this terrain?
And if you want to boil it down to three core principles, those would be, first, the willingness to learn from the enemy, and we've seen plenty of examples of that today. The sword from the Catiberians, the chainmail from the Celts, the heavy cavalry from the Parthians. Rome never had a problem with adopting ideas and developing them further.
Second, standardization and logistical thinking. The fabrica, the state weapons factories, mass production with quality control. That was the foundation that allowed this vast empire to function at all. Without standardized equipment, there's no standardized training, no interchangeable spare parts, no rapid re-equipping after losses.
And third, what I perhaps find the most remarkable, systems thinking. No single Roman weapon was inherently superior on its own. The gladius alone was just a short...
Exactly, just a sword. Without the scutum and the formation, it was nothing special. The pilum on its own was a clunky javelin that broke after a single use. But as a system, pilum destroys the shield, scutum punch knocks the enemy off balance, gladius finishes the job. The whole was far greater than the sum of its parts.
And what keeps coming back to me? The fall of Rome was not a failure of technology. The weapons continued to evolve right to the end. The plumbata was a clever solution. The cataphracts were an effective answer to Eastern cavalry. The Spangenhelm was actually an advance in production terms. The military kept innovating until the very end.
The causes lay elsewhere. Economic pressure, overstretched borders, political instability, the sheer number of simultaneous threats. In the end, the equipment wasn't the problem. It was the infrastructure that produced and distributed it that collapsed.
And yet, this legacy has endured. The concept of standardized mass production of military equipment, that's found in every modern army. The, well, NATO standardization, for example, where 30 nations used the same ammunition calibers so that logistics works smoothly. At its core, that's the same idea the Romans practiced in their fabricae.
And the modular lorica segmentata, where individual damaged plates could be swapped out without replacing the entire armour. That principle lives on in modern modular body armour, where ceramic plates are changed depending on the threat level. 2,000 years apart, but the underlying idea is the same.
Absolutely. And this interplay of different combat arms, infantry, cavalry, ranged warfare and siege warfare, in a coordinated fighting force, is the foundation of modern combined arms doctrine. The Romans didn't invent it, but they perfected it to a degree that set the standard for centuries.
What remains then is not the individual sword or the individual helmet. What remains are the principles. Pragmatism over dogma, system over individual solution, and the willingness to constantly adapt to changing realities.
And with that, we've reached the end of quite a long journey through Roman military history. I found it fascinating to go through it all so systematically once again.
I felt the same way. And if you, dear listener, have now been inspired to dive deeper into the subject, at battlemerchant.com, you'll find not only an extensive range of historical replicas from the Roman era and far beyond, but also many more articles on fascinating historical topics in the blog.
Feel free to check it out. And other than that, thank you so much for listening.
Until next time.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your swords sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.